The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener-supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1-month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and enjoy the interview.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 127. My special guest today is Christopher Barzak. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, quick things first. People may know you more from some of the previous books that you've written, both that came out from Bantam. I'm more familiar with One for Sorrow, but you also have written The Love We Share Without Knowing. And I think people are most familiar with One for Sorrow because it got like 8,000 award nominations, which, congratulations. And did you win the Spectrum? That may have went to... No. Jin Hale.
Yeah, I've won the Spectrum, but it was for a story called The Language of Moths.
Ah, okay. That's right, because it was the same year as Jin Hale's Wicked Gentleman.
Right.
And I recall, because I was on the committee, and I recall there were debates. So it was a tough call, because I loved both books. I loved Wicked Gentleman, and I loved One for Sorrow.
I love Wicked Gentleman too, so I don't feel bad losing to Wicked Gentleman.
Yeah, and I think One for Sorrow is certainly one of the best books from that particular decade. Easily one of the best, so I loved it.
I appreciate it. I'm glad you did.
So why don't we start with, since you've never been here before, the kind of big giant question that nobody is capable of answering, which is, what drew you into writing and why genre fiction in particular?
Well, I guess you could say that I don't know if I had to be drawn into writing. I was always interested in storytelling, just even orally when I was a little kid. I liked making up stories, and I actually, would try to make up stories that were what I thought was kind of frankly, content that was impossible, but to try to get, cousins or brothers or, friends to actually believe them. And if I could, then I felt like I was successful. I think I really just started to write out of that impulse to tell stories to people. I think I've always been writing as long as I was able to spell. I can remember getting an award for a short story that I wrote when I was in the third grade. Our elementary school had a little writing contest, and you had your awards, for each grade level. So there'd be somebody acknowledged at each grade level, but there was the school-wide award too for the contest. And I can remember feeling pretty good because I was in third grade and I won, and even beat out the fifth and sixth graders. So
wow.
Even then, in terms of the second part of your question, why genre, my mom found that story, in a shoebox somewhere recently. And, I looked at it, it was quite bad, but I was in third grade, I was 8 years old, but, even that story was, it was about an alien. So, I guess I've always been interested in things that were fantastical in nature or science fictional in nature. I always liked things that were impossible or seemingly impossible, that were different from the ordinary reality that I knew. And so I think it was just, a natural progression for me to write genre fiction, having that been my interest from the beginning.
And clearly that's continuing, even to the extent of almost super bizarreness, I guess is the way I would describe it, with your new collection, or yeah. I guess if you would call it a collection so much as mm-hmm. maybe a conceptual book, called Birds and Birthdays from Aqueduct Press. And to varying degrees, we were kind of talking off podcast, the kind of varying degrees of strangeness. You have the three mm-hmm. stories. There's Creation of Birds, which I think follows maybe a kind of almost a fairy tale sort of structure. You have mm-hmm. The Guardian, the Egg, which I think still has some of that there, but maybe more a contemporary. Mm-hmm. And then Birthday, which is even more contemporary and is in a strange way like an urban mythology, in a, just because of where it takes place inside of a large apartment complex.
Yeah.
And what I found really fascinating was the way that the book is put in is I had no idea this last chapter about surrealism. I was just reading these stories and finding them so strange and so fascinating for the kinds of interrelationships between characters. And even in some sense, like with The Guardian of the Egg, there's kind of like a relationship between character and the myth itself. And then you read in your this final chapter that all of this, to some extent, has come from your exploration of the surrealist movement. And I actually had hoped you'd want to talk about that. I'm not a surrealist expert. You'll probably know far more than I will. but I remember reading André Breton's The Surrealist Manifesto in like my freshman year of college and finding it so strange and fascinating in the kind of similar way to what you've done here. So how, I guess the kind of question I'm asking is, where did surrealism kind of become, like, how did you get to surrealism and then jump from that to, I'm going to write stories based on what I'm learning?
I'd always really enjoyed looking at surrealist artwork since I was a teenager. To me, it's just another mode of fantasy. It's fantasy that springs from the unconscious rather than from a consciously made kind of repertoire of literature of fantasy. So, you know, with epic fantasy, you know, we have things like dragons and elves and dwarves and things of that nature, you know, other world kind of fantasies. With surrealism, I think it's a fantasy, but it's a fantasy that springs out of the, of dreams and slightly askew versions of reality. And so I'm interested in pretty much any kind of fantasy. But I loved surrealism because it made me think outside of my own concepts of what fantasy literature is or fantasy artwork. And when I was in graduate school for the first time, back in 2000, I was doing a master's degree in literature between 2001 and 2003. And I'd sort of shaped the program, my graduate degree, so that it was as close to an MFA experience as possible. So I was allowed to do a creative thesis. I had been introduced that year by a friend to the artwork of Remedios Varo, and she was the artist whose work inspired me to write the first of the stories in Birds and Birthdays, The Creation of Birds. Her work was very different from anything I had seen in surrealist paintings, and it had lots of characters in it. It had what she called personages. And it felt like whatever painting of hers that you looked at, that all of it belonged to the same world, which was very different than my experience of looking at paintings by a lot of the male surrealist painters that are much more known and celebrated, both historically and even in the present. And where it seemed like in most of the artwork by male surrealists, that they were very anti-narrative, and you had landscapes that might have been anywhere, and, you know, like Dolly and, you know, clocks melting over things, or a kind of body that's been twisted and misshaped and has things, you know, composed within that body that we don't normally think of the human body having. Mm. You know, there's a famous painting of, you know, a woman's torso where the breasts, you know, are like the eyes of a face, and you know, the woman's vagina is a mouth, and it's very strange kind of painting, you know. And this is the kind of thing that men would do. It was very, very high concept, and like I said, there wasn't much of any kind of inferred story to their paintings. So when I came across Remedios Varo and her artwork, I was really stunned that, you know, she was, you know, working within that community at the same time. And why hadn't I seen anything by her? Why hadn't I heard anything about her? So I started to research her, and through my research on her, I came across the number of women artists who had been working in the surrealist mode too. Many of them that had just gone unheard of and weren't really given equal, you know, attention or sometimes just even excluded from exhibitions at the time, you know, in the time that they were working as young women. And many of them were attached to men in the surrealist movement, either as a girlfriend or as a close friend, sometimes even as a wife, and somehow, you know, we're still kept off in the margins of that whole movement of artists, that community. I found that very strange and compelling to find out more about it. I made it my graduate thesis for my master's degree to find out as much as I could about, you know, who these women are and also about the art. It, when I started to look at a number of the female artists of that movement, they all seemed to have narrative, inferred narratives in their paintings, and the representation of the female body, which is a huge icon in male surrealist paintings. It's used almost, you know, as a kind of coded, you know, metaphor for language or for social hierarchies even. Hmm. And because of that, because of this, the surrealists were all about sort of breaking down hierarchies and social orders and breaking down language and very anti-narrative, that sort of that female form really got distorted and broken apart in ways that you really very rarely will ever see the male form in a surrealist painting by a man depicted. So it really put a burden on the icon of the female body to hold a certain kind of meaning or anti-meaning than they did the male form. I don't think they did that purposefully. I think that it was just a part of their culture that, you know, and in many ways their privilege to not have to consider the male form in the same way and to not really think anything of using the female form in that way. But in any case, yeah, I found myself more interested in the women's work than the men's because it had narrative and yet still used surrealist technique. I love, you know, and I think, of course, I'm attracted to that because I'm a writer, because I'm interested in stories, and I loved the stories that were implied in their paintings. So out of my research on Remedios Varo, I came across Leonora Carrington, whose paintings inspired the second story in the book, The Guardian of the Egg. Mm. And they had been best friends, so of course I came across a lot of material about her in the biography I'd been reading about Remedios Varo. And, you know, in further research, I discovered an American painter named Dorothea Tanning, who married Max Ernst, a famous male surrealist painter, and who Leonora Carrington happened to have had a romantic relationship with years prior to their marriage. And that's actually how I came across Tanning, was through research on Carrington. And at that point, as I was sort of studying those three women and their work, I knew I wanted to create a kind of response to their work, but I didn't want to do it in the sort of typical critical dialogue that you would do in a master's thesis. And on top of that, they were artists, and I was, you know, a graduate student in literature. So trying to figure out how do I get to write about, you know, this stuff, but still make it viable and valid in an English department. And the thing that I figured out, the best way for me to respond would be through creative writing rather than critical writing, and to do a kind of transliteration of sorts of various of their artwork into narratives. So that's where I began writing the book and how I came to do that.
And even in the same chapter, I mean, you're kind of talking about the fact that these women had, to varying degrees, kind of been forgotten, in the sense that they were not given much space for their own work within the culture that they had been painting in, the Surrealist movement being largely a male movement, even though there were women within it. But of course, that's not unusual considering the time period. But then, of course, you know, that now you're in a sense trying to kind of play with their work in a way that maybe has not really been done before, precisely because that there isn't a lot of critical scholarship on them. And that, I think, was something you mentioned was one of your concerns, is you didn't want to be like the male surrealists who were kind of tearing apart the female body in the service of their art, not necessarily as like that was their intention to violate the female body, but in the sense you did not want to do the same thing for their work. You wanted their work, I guess, to be kind of its own universe.
Yeah, I really wanted it to be the kind of integral whole thing that I had seen in their work. So I wanted to treat it with great respect and to try to do it, to try to, in many ways, really listen. And as I looked at their work and read about their lives and the kind of exclusivity of the community that they belonged to try to bring all of that I was learning about them and seeing in their work to bear on the narratives that I was creating in response to their work, so that the stories that I wrote would hopefully feel like natural progressions from the paintings that I was looking at.
And sort of what you had said with the fact that perhaps one of the things that helped you see the narratives in these particular works is the fact that you are a writer. And I think to some extent that helps you take what appears to be a static object, a painting, since it presumably doesn't move, unless I guess maybe you're on LSD, it might move. but taking that and then saying, well, what is going on in this image, and trying to create a story. And that's, of course, what each of these three presents, is essentially a narrative that leads us somehow to the that static image, as though those artists had taken a picture of something, an event, and that was the image that started, and now you're filling in the blanks that are around it in a way.
Yeah, that's how I worked, especially with the second and the third story, both with The Guardian of the Egg and Birthday, is that I created a story that led to that, the image of the painting itself. It was a little bit different for me with The Creation of Birds, because Varro had such a huge body of work. And like I said, she painted a lot of different kind of fantasy personages, characters, and had a lot of settings that all felt all of a piece to the same world. So with that one, I was actually, I used several paintings as features for that story. I used her painting Creation of the Birds to have the sort of first scene and the first character of the story, which is the bird woman, and her romantic partner / nemesis, the Star Catcher, is also from his own painting of that same name, the Star Catcher. I used the the setting from a painting called Spiral Landscape, which is an island. It's just a painting of a spiral shaped island and this small little fantasy village that exists on it. And there was one other painting that I used, and this one was used in a little bit different kind of way. There's a painting that she did called Woman Leaving the Psychoanalyst, and I didn't use the woman depicted in that painting. What I did was place the bird woman character from Creation of the Birds painting into the same situation as the female figure leaving her psychoanalyst in that other painting, in which she has been given a bag of some kind that holds the head of either her father, some people think, in a kind of Jungian way, or the psychoanalyst himself, she's sort of leaving the psychoanalyst with more baggage than she went in with.
And I really love that because just, I mean, you know, coming from the 2000s, right, you know, there really aren't any psychoanalysts around here. I mean, it's presumably there's some still left in Europe, I'm told, by my professor who's a Lacanian, in love with Lacan. But that image of this, you know, she's not going to a psychologist or a psychiatrist, excuse me. You wouldn't go to a psychologist, that'd be weird. She's going to a psychoanalyst, which is, you know, it's very similar to a psychiatrist, but it's the image in my head is so different of the kinds of practice that would entail. And I just think that's so fascinating that here's this bird woman who is essentially a mythical being in and of herself, because her ability is essentially she creates the birds of the world, these magnificent creations. And yet she has deep-seated issues of her own and goes to this psychoanalyst. And I don't know, that I find that image just so fascinating, that here's the, you know, almost like a god in and of herself. It needs a psychoanalyst.
Right. Yeah, I kind of liked that. It was enjoyable for me to do that. I wanted both this kind of mythic feel in that particular story. Well, actually, even in the second one, too. But I wanted them, you know, to seem like a mythic being, but to have this really down-to-earth, mundane thing that a lot of people do, you know, that she needs to go to her therapist and talk.
So, well, since we're on the subject of this particular story, I mean, one of the things that I found really fascinating is the way that you have your characters positioned in terms of their relationship to their abilities. So you have, I mean, your main characters are the Bird Woman and the Star Catcher. And the Bird Woman, as I'd mentioned, she creates birds, and not just regular everyday birds like, you know, warblers and flamingos and what have you. She also is capable of creating some of the mythical birds we're familiar with, like phoenixes, etc. And her love interest / nemesis is the Star Catcher, who his name essentially says what he does. He can capture stars and essentially can like sell them. And that's part of what the Bird Woman does. She creates birds and then she kind of can sell them. And I think it's so interesting how the characters are positioned, almost like a yin and a yang, is the Bird Woman is creating a form of life, I guess you would say, in this attempt to present it to the world. Whereas the Star Catcher, and I think there's even a point in the story where it says so, he takes things and he doesn't like things he can't control, which that opposition, I mean, the Bird Woman is very much, you know, she'd be happy, I imagine, to just, I made a bunch of birds and now go fly and have fun. Right. Though she does control the birds too. If they're not ready, she doesn't let them go, but, which I guess is what a god would do. And I guess kind of talking about that opposition, I mean, when you were conceiving these two characters, because you say that they come from different paintings, I mean, what was your hope for kind of creating that relationship between them?
Well, I found a link, really, as I was looking at those two paintings. In the painting of Creation of the Birds, the Bird Woman of that painting is bringing what looks like to be like a common sparrow or something like that to life, lifting up off of a page where she's drawn it, but she's holding a kind of magnifying glass almost of some kind in her hand, and it's sort of focusing light that's coming in through her window from the stars and the moon at the sparrow. She also has several other things on the table that is this kind of alchemical mixture that seems to be able to bring the birds she draws to life. And I kept thinking as I looked at that one side by side with the star catcher that I wonder what she would do if this star catcher, who's holding a cage in his painting with a star inside it, if he were to deprive her of the source of the energy or sustenance that she needs to perform her art. As I started to sort of talk to myself about that, as this bird woman as a kind of artist figure, I started in some ways to see a kind of metaphor in some ways for perhaps Vara herself in the community she found herself in. And that the more I looked at her paintings, the more there was a kind of coded narrative beneath the surface of the fantasy representations that as I put that story together in my head, it seemed to me like it could be the story of her own kind of experience within that surrealist community, you know, being deprived of exhibitions, of attention, of recognition, you know, from reading her biography, she did go through relationships that were ultimately unworkable because of situations like that. So in some ways, her biography and the story of surrealism as a community itself started to filter into the story in that way. And both the Bird Woman and the Star Catcher kind of came to, for me at least, be representations of the male and the female within that community. I mean, that's very much off the page, obviously, but it is the kind of story I was telling myself as I created that narrative.
But I can actually kind of, I mean, since I don't know the history of the surrealists, but I did kind of see that there was almost a, you might call from a annoying academic perspective, a feminist critique here. I say that, you know, just because there are going to be some people rolling their eyes, and there goes Sean talking academia. But that, I think that is very much there because of the position of the two characters. You know, the star catcher being a man is, in a sense, in control or trying to control things, whereas the bird woman is just trying to present her art. And even the imagery, I mean, I'm sure if I sat down and started, you know, I don't know if I'm going to do this to you, but am I, who knows, you know, analyzing all of the symbology, you know, I mean, thinking of in terms of, you know, why is it significant that the bird woman is making birds, and why is it significant the star catcher is making stars? There's such a fascinating kind of gender issue going on. And now that you bring up the fact that this is perhaps also a reflection of her personal history, that the author's history or the artist's history, that even adds more layers in a sense.
Yeah, it's an archetype story in a lot of ways. I mean, I think the story of women in surrealism, you know, in some ways is the story of women in a patriarchal culture. So in that way, the story I created, you know, those characters sort of taking on that archetypal story, is, I think, you know, in its way, a feminist critique of patriarchal culture.
And yet relayed through, what is essentially a fairy tale. I mean, it has a very similar format to what we might see as a traditional fairy tale. There's some differences, obviously. I mean, it's not going to match one for one, but it is interesting in that sense too, that it has that fairy tale feel, you know, as though if not for the fact that it's written in modern language, if we went back 300 years and translated it into whatever version of English existed then, it could have been you know, this kind of radical fairy tale for the time.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the beauties of it is here is it's almost deceptive. You know, as you start and it's like, well, the bird woman, she's sitting at her table and she's making birds. And it's like, well, this is just, you know, and then it's like, wait, no, there's all of these deep layers into this bird, the bird woman's psyche, essentially, and her relationship. It's not just a fairy tale. It's
a kind of modern psychological perception within it, too.
Yeah, that's my favorite story from I love the whole collection, but that one's my favorite.
Yeah, that was the favorite of the reviewer at Strange Horizons who reviewed the book too.
I just love the bird woman. I wish I could create birds.
I know. It'd be pretty awesome.
It would be pretty cool. So, well, I don't want to take up all the time talking about my favorite story. There are two other wonderful stories in here too. I think the one I want to focus on for a moment is actually Birthday, which is the third story in the lot and is also obviously, as you had indicated, influenced by one of the paintings. All of them are, but this is one of the ones where it's leading us up to the painting itself. And the basic idea of the story is a woman who's more or less unsatisfied with the way her life is currently going, and who takes on all of these different kind of personas in an attempt to possibly to fill a gap or something like that, but all taking place in the same apartment complex. So she's bringing all of these other people into this complex, trying to make those connections. And I guess kind of to get you to start talking about it, what did you see in terms of the relationship perhaps from the character to that kind of inner unchecked discomfort with maybe being disconnected from either her humanity or some kind of, I'm rambling through what is not a very coherent question, but I mean, kind of talking about what was your method, your practice in trying to kind of weave this story together.
With Birthday, it's that story is titled the same as the painting itself that I was working with, by Dorothea Tanning. And, it had a very different feel than either the Varro or the Tanning paintings that I worked with. And it was largely because it was clearly set within a more modern, apartment style structure of this woman that was dressed in a very theatrical kind of costume, but she was baring her breasts and she was sort of like half undressed, but she's staring right out at the viewer as if she can see them. Like there's this, you know, wall being broken down. And it was very much in some ways working in the genre of like self-portraiture. The woman really is Tanning in that one. There's no escaping it. This was kind of strange because, you know, the self-portrait is a very old and traditional kind of form of painting. The setting that she's placed herself in is this, you know, stark, bare apartment where behind her is this kind of like hallway full of doors that look like they're sort of opening and closing of their own volition, with all this sort of like potential, you know, of other rooms and other people possibly being inside them. And then beside her is this strange creature that no one has ever really been able to name, any of the people whose criticism of the painting that I read, you know, where they tried to interpret it in some ways. Everybody has different ideas, and a lot of people come to the conclusion that it's simply an uncatalogued fantasy creature that kind of looks like a lemur with wings. I loved that it was like, you know, this mix of, you know, this sort of modern space and in this very traditional form of self-portraiture, but it had those just sort of off to the side, strange, magical qualities, one with the creature and then one with the doors sort of flapping open and closed behind her. So I knew that I really wanted to work in a more modern, or like you said earlier, a kind of urban space. And I began trying to figure out what that setting would be and what the iconography from the painting itself might lead to in terms of narrative. So for me, I was kind of interpreting that painting that she had placed herself, you know, side by side with an uncatalogued fantasy creature, you know, in what was a self-portrait, as a way of sort of unclassifying herself, you know, taking herself out of a catalog, that she's just as much, you know, this a fantasy creature in some ways as the creature that she's imagined in the painting. And I really liked the idea of the doors behind her as these kind of like potentials for other identities when a person or a creature is unidentified and uncatalogued or unclassified, then, you know, they're unnamed, and in that way their identity is fluid. And so I knew that I wanted to write about this kind of fluid identity that this character is experiencing. So I created the character of Emma, whose parents had owned an apartment building in the city, and in an accident they had passed away both together, and left her the building at a very young age. And I think she's around 20, 19 or 20 when they die. And from there, you know, she goes through this kind of experience of trying to find herself within this sort of very circumscribed world of the apartment building she's been left, because she becomes almost agoraphobic in some ways about going outside. The world's almost too big for her, and her life has been, you know, changed radically and unexpectedly. So she begins to sort of live just within the world of the apartment building and starts to create identities for herself within that kind of microcosm of the larger world, and trying on selves, different selves, as if they were clothes or constructs of some kind. And as she does this, she mainly does this by kind of taking over the lives of some of her tenants, whose identities she's attracted to having in some way, because each one has some different kind of life from her own. And as she starts to sort of role play, she also wants, you know, she begins to kick tenants out because she wants to fully inhabit that persona. By the end of the story, she's really got not very many tenants and a life that's no longer her own. She, you know, she realizes as she's been taking other people's, it sort of comes full circle back to who she had been prior to her to this kind of rupture in her life with her parents dying and inheriting this building at a young age, and remembers the things that she liked to do before that rupture and how she felt about things then. And she begins to paint her self-portrait, which is leads to the painting that Tanning herself painted called Birthday. And throws a birthday party for herself. She tries to bring everyone back around and start to at least try to make amends if they'll let her. That's kind of the path I took. I'm not sure if it's a good description of the path I took, but it's the kind of associations. It was very associational kind of transliteration of that painting.
And the questions about her identity, I think, is really interesting, because there is a moment in the story when one of the people she's engaged with, I don't know if that's the appropriate term, but that she's having some kind of a relationship with, and actually tries to paint her, and mm-hmm. she leaves immediately after seeing it and going, that's not it, no, like, I'm gone.
Yeah, she ends up getting into a relationship with a painter who... you know, paints her, and she's unhappy with how she's been represented. And that's when she It's the final straw, and she leaves.
And it, I think it's really interesting from that too, because of the it kind of the way it plays into this question of her identity. Because, in you know, here she is, she's jumping from my essentially identity to identity, like you said, like they're, you know, different suits essentially, trying these different ways on. And here's somebody who is, you know, she's tried on a new identity, and this person's like, well, I'm going to try to capture you, but it's not what she expects is what is going to be captured. And so there's almost I mean, this is, I think this is in the middle of the story somewhere. It's almost as if she, because she does not know yet what or who she is, the idea that she can be captured by anyone at any moment, it's not sufficient.
Right.
You know, she hasn't cooked enough yet, I guess you could say.
Yeah, yeah. In that whole sort of trying on, you know, different lives, and I think that the thing that she comes to the conclusion of is that, you know, it's not, you know, an identity that you can take off of a rack, but that, you know, she sort of comes to that idea that you do create your own self rather than borrowing.
Yeah, and then of course the end of the story, roughly the end, when she meets the creature we've talked about, which completely throws her for a loop, because much like herself, as you've indicated, you know, she doesn't quite fit anywhere. She doesn't have a secure identity. It's very fluid. And yet here is a creature which makes no sense within the context of the reality she's essentially been raised to live in, because it's not anything that exists. I mean, it would be almost like, you know, waking up one day and finding out that goblins are real. You know, we think about goblins, you know, in a kind of silly way. But if you'd met a goblin and he was having a conversation with you, it would be this bizarre, strange moment.
Right. But if they were part of our world, and we would incorporate them into it, and we would come to our own understanding, a kind of anthropological understanding of what goblins are and how they act and how they behave. And in some ways, in that cataloging, you know, also kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know, creates the expectation of how goblins should be.
It's, I think it's just so fascinating, the identity, and even in the painting, as you were describing, you know, that even the scholars are, they have no idea. Like, and they're arguing, they're probably having arguments like, well, you know, maybe she meant this creature, which kind of looks like a lemur bird monkey. But maybe, yeah, she meant that.
Different scholars. It was quite funny reading some of the art criticism and interpretations. There were some that really were trying really hard to identify what that creature was, and I would always laugh. Like, you know, to me, I'd already come to the point where I thought that was kind of the point, that you know, you're not able to catalog that creature, which is, I think, what the painting itself is saying about Tanning, what she's saying about herself through the painting, that you cannot classify me.
And to some extent, I mean, it even perhaps related to the sort of surrealist movement itself, is kind of rejecting those kinds of categories and these very rigid ways of doing things. And I mean, if I were one of the things, I think Breton, you would know him better than I would, but I think I recall him saying something like, you know, you're just not supposed to think when you come up with a surrealist sentence. You're just supposed to kind of like, yep, free write it, and just whatever the hell comes out is, that's it.
Yeah.
Know? And so, I mean, even with a painting like that, I mean, on the one hand, you can't quite have that same idea with a painting, because I mean, I guess you could, but it wouldn't look like anything, because it would just be random things popping out. But there it is, this image that is unclassifiable. I mean, and even in this, the same extent, like bringing in, like as you had said, the traditional self-portraiture, and then rupturing that whole idea with something that is not part of that,
right,
that structure. And I guess you could, you, in a sense, it plays in the story in all those unique ways in terms of her identity, all of the different ways in which she's trying on these things and is not able to even classify herself, and refuses to be classified by others, because that, even if she doesn't know who she is yet, she knows she's not that.
Right. Yeah. She's sort of defining by trial and error, sometimes defining in opposition to something else.
Yeah. So, okay, let's switch to the second story then, The Guardian of the Egg, and then we'll kind of close out, I think, unfortunately. So one of the interesting things I think about this story is it somewhat goes back to some of the kind of the roots that have existed in some of your other work in terms of dealing with younger people. In particular, the character's sister begins to have some kind of a bizarre condition. And if I recall correctly, she's growing a tree out of her head.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just making sure I'm not mixing you up with another story. So she's growing these limbs and other things out of her head. And, you know, in a world where that's not supposed to happen, and there's some bizarreness and connection between her and the forest. And it turns out that the title has a lot to do with it. I won't say anything more than that. But kind of going back to all of these questions of identity again is, you know, the parents trying to understand, well, what the hell is happening to our daughter, and the brother who's also trying to understand and has no idea what's going on, but yet he's being asked by her just to kind of trust her.
Mm-hmm.
In whatever's happening, because she knows what's going on. So it kind of, in a sense, goes back to, the kind of questions are related in One for Sorrow, with the main character who, in a sense, is lost in his own unique ways. And here we have these young people who are being transformed, the brother, in a sense, by what's happened to his sister. And his sister, whose perspective we really don't get, is being literally transformed. So we have these two transformations. Could you talk about, maybe in connection to the kind of the work that you'd originally envisioned for this, but also the ways in which you were kind of playing with this younger set of characters?
Sure. That story is in response to a Leonora Carrington painting that is known by a couple of different names. And in my research, it was referred to in both ways by whoever it happened to be writing about it. One of the titles of the painting was The Guardian of the Egg, and the other title was Baby Giant. And actually, there was a third that I came across at times called The Giantess. And I really loved that the painting had so many different names and it didn't seem to have been settled on. And I loved it, too, because each of the different titles gave me a different way of looking at the painting, which is of this, you know, this giantess that's sort of, you know, coming ashore of a small rural village. And they've got, like, you know, Viking-like boats out in the water, and there's farmers and their wives sort of coming out of the forest off to the side of the shore with pitchforks and things like that. And but the giantess herself, her face is very much like, you know, very young. And I think that's where they get the one title, The Baby Giant. She's got, you know, geese coming out of this large orange cloak that she has, and her hair is, you know, made of wheat. And she seems like she's this kind of nature goddess of some kind. And I wanted to write a story that, again, sort of enveloped that image, but put it in a slightly modern setting of suburbia, of American suburbia, rather than a sort of rustic village as it is in the painting itself, because it did seem like there's this sort of archetypal goddess coming up to the shore and sort of disrupting the society that is living there. And I thought it would be interesting to see that play out in a more modern setting as well, which can be just as stifling as old rustic peasant villages and things of that nature. But I took the point of view of telling the story from the girl who starts to transform into that giantess, this kind of nature goddess, from her brother. I wrote it from the brother's perspective for a couple of reasons. I thought that, looking at the painting, that it really did signify a transformation in a number of ways, both transformation like within the self, but also, you know, perhaps unwittingly transforming, you know, the world around you. So I wanted, you know, anything with transformation, in some ways, I, you know, it goes back to adolescence for me, that time when, you know, we are literally transforming, our bodies are changing, the way that we're able to perceive the world are changing as we gain more and more experience and, you know, sort of being subjected to more adult experiences in our lives. And so I wanted to place it in a sort of adolescent setting in that way. And I wanted to tell it from the girl's younger brother's perspective, mainly because as I was developing this project, since it was so much about issues that, of women that they're facing in the cultures that they belong to and are a part of, that I wanted to have a young man as a perspective for one of the stories who might actually be transformed himself by recognizing his sister coming into the kind of power that is generally the kind of privileged kind of position that males enjoy, and not being able, you know, being frustrated at least initially by not being able to access that, and also from you know, of course, being estranged from society by association with this, his sister, who's become, you know, this powerful entity of sorts, and sort of realizing by association with her what that does feel like to be pushed off to the margins, and sort of understanding sometimes that story of being the chosen one, it isn't always going to be about you, you know, that sometimes it's going to be someone else, and it might be your sister, it might be your wife, it might be your girlfriend, it might be your mother. So many stories seem to revolve around men sort of being chosen ones and having to sort of go out and save the world in some way, and this boy had to sort of learn how to live with not being the chosen one, but then also to be transformed into this person who's able to help his sister, to assist. So in many ways, you know, he's kind of the sidekick, but he's got the main perspective in the story.
And it is very interesting when you think of it in terms of the kind of the chosen one narrative, because you're right, you know, it's usually men, but sometimes it's women who are the chosen ones. But sometimes those stories aren't necessarily as interesting as the other kinds of stories would be that would surround that. So like the sidekicks, or what about the poor bastard who did, like, you know, the step cousin, or like the brother, or, you know, what happens to all those other people who are surrounding this person but aren't necessarily part of the prophecy or whatever is going on that is leading that. And I think it's very interesting that's what you've done here, is you've presented the brother. What the hell? Why? Who is calling me? Okay, evil people are calling me.
Oh, no.
Sorry. But anyway, I'm not even going to bother trimming it out. But so kind of going to that question about, you know, what happens to those people who aren't who aren't the ones who deal with, you know, defeating the giant or saving the world or what have you, but actually are suffering in their own ways from being associated with that person. And I think that's fascinating. It would be even fascinating too to have like a story about someone who thought they were a chosen one, but it turns out they're not.
Yeah.
You know?
Excellent. For a while, I think there's a series of young adult novels by Ray Carson that the first book at least feels very much like that narrative, where there's the main character is a girl who's kind of a chosen one character, but for the longest time she's unable to actually do anything, and unable to access her own power, and that's interesting. I really found that interesting as I was reading that first book, The Girl of Fire and Thorns. Where that you kind of have a character who's been told all her life that she's the chosen one, but she's unable to actually do anything. She's just been told that.
And that's, I think, somewhat even a more interesting story than if she had been the chosen one.
Right.
Maybe perhaps because it's we like the Chosen One story, maybe because it makes us feel somewhat in control. Like, here is a world and it's ordered, and the Chosen One gets, they get their magic powers or whatever, and they save the world, and that's the end of the story. But what if your hero is the person, like you said, you know, they thought they were the Chosen One, but they have no special ability, and they're not the Chosen One. They're just a normal schmuck like the rest of us. And how then did they...
How do they operate in that world? There's a novel in stories called China Mountain Zhang by Maureen McHugh that is kind of in some ways the science fiction version of that kind of story, where all of the characters in it are just people who are really just living in the world. It's a futuristic world where China has become the dominant power, and everyone sort of works for China in that book and on some level. All of the characters in it, these Americans, are all just people who, you know, they have a kind of daily job. They're trying to live their lives, and there's no one saving the world. They're just sort of trying to get by in their own way and to find their own place within that world that's been created. And I think when I read that book, it was the book that sort of gave me this idea that I think it's just as interesting to read about people who aren't, you know, doing anything other than going to work or you know, trying to pay the bills or, you know, sort of facing, you know, just as much of the features of this transformed world that is part of the book as anyone else, but aren't necessarily people in any kind of position of power to do anything other than to exist within it. And that in and of itself, just sort of like exploration of the mundane lives of in a radically altered world, I think is interesting. I know that not everybody's looking for that kind of reading experience, but it was one that I really enjoyed. And so I wanted to sort of depict that in The Guardian of the Egg in a particular way.
Mm-hmm. Have you read Maureen McHugh's After the Apocalypse?
I have. Yeah, I've read everything that Maureen has written. I think she's a fantastic writer.
Yeah, I was really glad when I got a review copy of After the Apocalypse. It was so good.
That's a great collection.
Yeah, I agree. So we're kind of winding down here, unfortunately, because some of us have to sleep. Although I guess you're a writer, so you're probably an insomniac by default, right?
I do, rather late writing.
So just a really quick, just kind of smaller question, then I'll kind of ask the closing out kind of questions. Since you work with, this book has come out with Aqueduct Press, and they're a small press, and they're, I almost want to say they're like the activist genre fiction press, in the sense that, their conversation pieces have featured a lot of what you might call feminist genre fiction. And even some of their posts have been explored questions of, you know, women in genre, what's the state of women in genre, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a very interesting press, I think, in that sense. But it is a small press, so it's not Bantam, which you were with for your previous, your novels, your two novels. So what was kind of your experience in working with a small press?
It was great. I'm really glad that they exist. And small presses, independent presses, they serve a function that is absolutely necessary. And large publishers would never have, first of all, you know, been interested in publishing a book that is essentially only 100 pages of text. Short story collections in general have, you know, sort of gone out of fashion within large corporate publishing houses. They're considered to not make money, but the way that a novel can. And so a lot of independent presses are picking up the slack for things that, you know, corporate publishing doesn't feel like will turn a major profit for them. And I had not worked with a small press on a book prior to this one, but it was excellent. I was edited just as thoroughly as I had been by Bantam. you know, multiple rounds and looking at different kinds of things in each of those rounds of editing. And the care that they took in the production of the book, I thought, was wonderful. Even on the level of just like creating ornaments for scene breaks and stuff. You know, each story has its own ornaments that sort of come into the space with scene breaks. And I didn't expect that kind of care, because I know small presses don't necessarily always have the kind of resources that a large, you know, corporate press has to invest so much time in the production of a book. And so I was really thrilled that the editors there, you know, really did throw themselves into the production of this book the same way that I had experienced with Bantam. One thing that was great beyond that was, I had the ability to in some ways select my own cover art. And was able to use a painting that a friend of mine in Michigan had done, and that was really just completely appropriate for the collection, I thought. So there is that. You really would never get the ability to choose cover art for your book from a large corporate press.
Oh no, never.
You're sort of given what you're given, and you know, you might have consultation rights and stuff like that, but largely, you know, the marketing department in conjunction with the art department is going to come up with the design, and doesn't really matter, you know, what you think to a large degree.
Because they're trying to, they're basing it on what they assume is going to sell the book the most.
Trying to create a kind of look that they think will help sell the book in large corporate publishing houses. And I completely understand that. But it was really fun to be able to sort of personalize this one a little bit. On top of all of those great things that come with small or indie presses, Aqueduct in particular is, I think, a really necessary kind of independent press within the science fiction and fantasy genre. It does bring a kind of a different kind of conversation around the literature of science fiction and fantasy, because they don't take a commercial approach, but are trying to look at science fiction and fantasy from a more cultural perspective, rather than a culture of, say, fandom, or a culture of just, you know, capitalism, you know, in terms of, you know, the publishers needing, you know, to make, you know, profit. So they're selecting books to publish at Aqueduct that they feel are necessary, or that are useful in having a good conversation that is, you know, intellectual or academic about science fiction, fantasy, and specifically about women within that genre of literature. And I was thrilled they existed as a publisher, because I had written this, you know, small book that I really don't think there might be another publisher, you know, that would have looked at it, that it would have fit their mission. Because it certainly, you know, doesn't fit the sort of, you know, mission of large corporate publishing at all, which is sort of bottom line, let's make money.
Right, and it is a kind of, in a way, you might almost say it's an experimental collection, in the sense that its overarching element is the surrealist stuff that we've discussed. I mean, that isn't even, I guess you could say, normal in short story collections. I mean, most short story collections are, well, here is, you know, X author, and here's a whole bunch of stuff from their career, right? They may have some linkages, but they're not really. These, however, like, well, these, each of them are connected in a very specific way. And even as you say, with Aqueducts, dealing in particular with women, it has its own kind of mission within the collection. And I think you're right that my exposure to Aqueduct has been fairly small, but I do think that they're a necessary voice.
Yeah. Yeah. They bring something to the table that I don't think any press, particularly, you know, any press within science fiction and fantasy sort of offers on a regular basis.
Yeah. And it's and to some extent, I think that's good and sad at the same time.
Yeah.
So, my cat is now biting me. Really? We're gonna play this game now?
It's time for him to be interviewed.
Yeah. Getting there. Give me a minute, cat. So what can folks expect from you in terms of writing or like maybe convention appearances, that kind of thing in the next year?
I have a new book coming out in late March called Before and After Lives, and that's a full-length short story collection, about 250 pages, and 17 short stories that sort of range from the beginning of my writing career, which started in 1999, and up until 2012. A lot of those stories are stories that are ghost stories or supernatural tales. And hence the title. And but it is a mixed genre collection. There's some science fiction in it as well. I don't really write a lot of science fiction, but occasionally I do. So there are three sci-fi stories in it, although I'm sure some readers would debate at least whether one of them is science fiction or not. But I think science fiction. In any case, that's coming out in late March. I plan on being the International Conference for the Fantastic in the Arts down in Florida.
I will be there.
Excellent. We can meet finally. and that's in late March as well. I'm going to be going to WISCON at the end of May in Madison, Wisconsin. And I plan on going to ReaderCon in Boston in mid-July. And I'm giving a reading at KGB bar in Manhattan in September. So that's what I've got planned so far. And other than that, at some point, more probably along the lines of 2014, if anyone was a fan of my first book, One for Sorrow, it's being made into a movie right now called Jamie Marks is Dead. And that should be coming out in 2014.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Yep. Oh man. Okay, it's called what? Hold on.
Jamie Marks is Dead.
Oh, come on, IMDb. Is it on IMDb?
It is. It's just got the director and scriptwriter and producers listed right now. Sort of scheduled to start filming in the next few months.
I'm guessing it's an indie production?
It's an indie production. It's from Hunting Lane Films. The director and the scriptwriter is Carter Smith, who did The Ruins. And one of the producers is John Logan, who is sort of known for as a scriptwriter, but he also is occasionally a producer. He wrote scripts for like things like Hugo and The Gladiator and Any Given Sunday, stuff like that. Carter Smith, his first major feature film was from DreamWorks. It was called The Ruins, and it was based on a novel of the same name. And he also has won a Sundance Award for a film he made called Bug Crush in 2007. In Hunting Lane Films, they're a kind of, you know, art house film producer that has done stuff like Half Nelson and Blue Valentine, which are films that, despite being independent, have reached wider audiences and a lot of times, you know, get recognized with award nominations or wins and things like that. So I'm hoping that, and I think they're hoping probably too, that it will be a film that reaches wider audiences.
I hope so. I think some of the best work in genre film right now is being done through the sort of indie market, either by like independent filmmakers, just people throwing stuff up on YouTube, or people who are part of like small indie film companies. I mean, you just look at like there was Another Earth, even Melancholia was a fairly smaller production than would be normal. I mean, all of this stuff. And even my favorite independent film ever was an adaptation of Harrison Bergeron called 2081. And it's like a 24-minute movie, and it's an amazing production.
Have to look it up. Yeah, I think that independent filmmakers can do the kind of thing that independent presses are do too. Is that, you know, you know, a lot of Hollywood based, you know, corporate film houses are, they have this, you know, everything's about the bottom line, and, you know, a lot of good stuff, they themselves, you know, producers and directors say goes by because they don't think that they can market it to be blockbuster material. And you know, I think that's something that both New York Publishing and Hollywood, you know, film houses are looking for is the next blockbuster and not necessarily the next good movie. And so, you're going to get a different kind of experience in, of film from an independent filmmaker.
That's going to be incredible. I can't wait.
Yeah, I'm excited too.
So, and the last question I've got is, where do people find you?
Online, you can find me at christopherbarzak.com. I occasionally, you know, update on there anything that's going on in terms of if I'm going to show up anywhere or if I have new publications coming out. And you can sort of link to any of my social networks through that, whether on Facebook or Twitter. And, otherwise, you know, physically, I'm located in Youngstown, Ohio. I teach creative writing at Youngstown State University. So if you're ever passing through, you can pop on by.
Oh, cool. So I love the collection, and I'm hoping that people who listen to this go buy like 8,000 copies and love it too. But thank you so much for coming on. I know we had to reschedule a couple of times, but I appreciate it.
Oh, no, thanks for having me. It's been cool. Fun.
So everybody go check out his book, Birds and Birthdays, and keep an eye out for all the cool stuff that's coming out, the new book coming out this year, and then the new movie, the most awesome thing. Yeah. So see everybody later. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.